is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. I will call our third case for the day, Officer Lawyer Regulation versus Wagner. Before I do, you will notice that the chair next to me on my right, where Justice Abrahamson generally sits, is empty. She has withdrawn from participation, so she will not play any role in this case. Attorney Wagner, are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, I couldn't hear you.
Please do.
First, I would like to thank the court for giving me this opportunity.
Just one second. I'm not hearing her. Is there a way of helping the volume a little bit?
Maybe pull the microphone
down.
Maybe
pull it a little bit towards you.
She said she couldn't hear you either, so we must be having difficulties.
Yes.
Now I couldn't hear you either, Justice Rogensack.
Okay. All right. I'm hearing you better now. Are you hearing me better now?
Yes.
Okay. Let's start the clock running again. Please begin. Thank you.
I would first like to begin by thanking the court for giving me this opportunity to do an oral argument. As this court is aware, I've had a lot of health problems the last 8 years, and I was delayed in doing a reply brief because I was having additional problems, and in fact, I've just been allowed to return to work at the beginning of February for 2 half-days a week. But the good news is that the cancer is gone. And after I complete the rehab for the pelvic muscles, the bladder and bowel issues, I should be able to be back in work, at work full-time in April. And I'm very, very pleased about that. It's been a long time. I'm going to be trying to present two different approaches to this. One is looking at a couple of documents that I'd like the court to consider. And the other is I'm going to try to present a timeline. And to keep it as simple as possible, because there are a lot of documents in this case. And in fact, there were over 8,500 emails with attachments, and that doesn't count all of the other work that was done. So there's a lot of material here, and I want to try to keep it as simple as possible. I'd like to call the court's attention to look at four documents in specific as we go through this today. The first one is docket number 17. Docket number 17 was submitted by OLR as addendum A for their support of their May 28th motion for preclusion. And that particular addendum A is the actual 56-page oral ruling and findings from Judge Neese in 10 CV 5854. That is a very important document as we go through this today, because there was a 6-day trial in front of Judge Neese the week of April 15th of 2013. 2.5 days were given to Timothy Graves, and the last 2.5 were given to me. And when you look at those rulings, you will see that basically the court found at least 4 points that I had underbilled the case, and also that the true party was Jonathan Graves, the death successor trustee, and myself as representing Wagner Law Offices SC. And in addition to that, indicated that particular 6-day trial focused on whether or not I personally was representing Wanda Lee Graves as opposed to having as my client the trust. And I think that's one of the things that has been overlooked in this entire circus that has gone on with four different lawsuits. And that is the fact that if they could argue that I was representing her personally, I wasn't entitled to any, my firm wouldn't be entitled to any fees whatsoever from the trust. And the two branches of facts presented to, before this court as part of a summary judgment are whether or not Mr. Timothy Graves was doing what he did to try to force a final invoice from me, or, as I projected in all of my materials, that I believe that this situation where the privity doctrine should have been applied to Timothy Graves, because his objective was not to pay any fees at all. And that came through very clearly in the rulings from Judge Neese, and I'll go over those in a moment. So I would like you to look at docket number 17, those 56 pages, and I'll go over about five or six of those very quickly in my time. I also want you to look at Exhibit R from the submissions from OLR. That is the actual pleadings. That is the actual document that led to the four different lawsuits. And that in that document, you will see that the pleadings themselves show this was all about not paying me any fees at all. It was all about the beneficiary trustee, Timothy Graves, believing that I should have signed a representation agreement with him after his mother died, and that the estate should have paid any fees. But, of course, there was no estate, because when you do a living trust, your objective is to have everything done in the living trust, so there will not be any probate. So that was sort of a sad argument. And the counter to this that I'm going to be presenting is looking at the what really happened on December 30th of 2009. Because on December 30th, 2009, what happened is that Jonathan Graves, the death successor trustee, issued a check to my law firm totaling $113,000 plus the $7,000 that had already been paid for coming up with a plan for Mrs. Graves, the trustee, the prior summer. And when that check was cut, Timothy Graves couldn't handle that. He couldn't handle my getting paid $120,000. And he proceeded, and I will go through the sequence of what he did, trying to, in essence, interject himself. There are let me back up then now. And so we're also going to be looking at, in addition to...
Who paid you the $120,000?
Pardon?
Who signed the check that caused you to be paid $120,000.
There were two checks. There was
all right,
one.
Well, who signed
the
each of the checks?
Was it death successor trustee Jonathan Graves?
He signed them.
He signed the
okay.
check.
Okay.
Because he believed at that point that I should have been paid something because of all the work that had been done. And I'd like to indicate that this was a $4 million trust. We're not talking about a small trust. I'm going to, first of all, back up now.
Can I ask you, how is Jonathan Graves related to Timothy Graves?
Oldest brother of the family.
Say it again?
The oldest brother.
Okay, thank you very much.
And he also resided in the Cross Plains area.
Okay.
And he also had worked extensively with the parents and helped because the trust contained a lot of real estate, apartment buildings, etc. And this man not only had a degree in construction from the UW School of Agriculture, but he was close and he helped with those apartment buildings. And he also had a similar trust document that was done by the Wilson Law Group between himself and his wife.
Okay.
So he was very qualified. And, in fact, under Article 15 of the trust, the parents had designated either that this oldest brother would handle the trust work, or if he wasn't willing or able to, that then there would be a corporate fiduciary. They never indicated that Mr. Timothy Graves would be involved at all.
Can I ask you, did Timothy ever represent Jonathan in any of these lawsuits or proceedings?
Yes, that's one of the questions that I'll be getting to. Jonathan represented himself pro se. And you will see, find that under my in my answer in the pleadings in paragraph number 59, that he was pro se. And none of the siblings were represented by Timothy Graves. He gave this appearance in the arbitration agreement that he filed. He was trying to get there first, okay? He was trying to put himself in the center. Let me back up on this because there are three things that happened. There was one trust initially, one count initially done relative to why I gave Mrs. Graves the check back, and that has now been recommended to be dismissed by OLR. The third count, the most serious one, was they suggested I had overbilled excessive fees. Judge Nace found in his findings, which you will see, as I said, in docket number 17, four times he talked about the fact that I had underbilled the case. And I don't understand why OLR ever even made that charge of misconduct, because they had the findings from the preliminary hearing on April 24th of 2013. They had requested them, the investigator had requested them and had them since December 16th of 2013. So all of that material was available to OLR, all of Judge Neese's findings after 6 days, and still they filed that charge against me. And that was dismissed on August 16th of 2016 because the director of OLR finally, after having an expert witness, realized that it was very unlikely that OLR would be able to meet its burden of proving that there had been excessive fees.
You have a very complicated case with a lot of facts. I had thought, after reviewing what has been presented to us, that we were here today to simply talk about count two, which is an alleged violation of 20:1.5, parent B, parent, and three, and that was taking too long to give a submission of a billing invoice. That was the focus of that. Is there something other than that count that you think is before us?
Well, actually, what happened is the scope of the case that I did. Let me just back up a second. Under the we indicated, both sides have indicated, that we accepted the standards as put forth by the referee. And however, I also would like this court to follow Kramer Brothers and United States Fire Insurance Company, because of the, which is 99 West 2nd, 555-6657, because in that case it talks about the court being able to look at other documents, other pleadings that have been made in the other cases with this. And so you'll be able to look at Judge Neese's materials under that ruling. And you will also be able to look at the case that was filed by Timothy Graves in Adams County. From the very outset in this particular case, Timothy Graves second-guessed everything that Jonathan Graves and I tried to do. And in fact, the very first activity that I did on January 17th, when I was finally authorized to proceed with this case, the Wanda Lee Graves was concerned that Jonathan Graves would be forced out of being the death successor trustee. She was being pressured. And on that date, I had the siblings who were all home. It was Martin Luther King weekend in 2009. And I had them all sign a document that waived Mrs. Graves' necessity of having to give a 30-day notice to resign as death as the actual sole trustee at that point. And that covered up a loophole so that no one could go into court that week and try to get appointed in Jonathan's place as the potential death successor trustee. And that's important because in the documents that I'd like you to look at when I look at the case in 10 CV 9854, which is document R, the docket R, so filed by OLR. You're going to be looking at what was actually pled. But there's one thing that happened before that I'd like to call your attention to, and that is the case that Timothy Graves, the beneficiary trustee, filed in Adams County on a 38-year-old land dispute while Jonathan Graves was out of the country on vacation. That lawsuit was filed while he was gone, and it put the final work for the Graves Living Trust on suspension. When Jonathan was coming back from his fishing trip in Canada, it was our intent to do the final title work for the real estate that the niece and the daughter received, and we had a few assets to distribute, and then we would be done. But when Timothy went off and did this without his brother's approval, without a representation agreement from his brother, which you will find under my Exhibit K with my summary judgment submissions on October 17th of 2016, you'll find that under Exhibit K, the very first two pages talk about the fact that Jonathan Graves admitted in a deposition on the 17th of February 2012 that he had not signed a representation agreement with Timothy Graves to file that suit in Adams County. But what it did is it suspended our work because Jonathan Graves would have not be able to aver to the title company that there was nothing pending that might alienate the assets in the trust. So basically, Jonathan Graves and I were put on hold from Timothy's filing of that lawsuit in Adams County on the 18th of September 2009 until it was finally dismissed out on August 10th of 2010. And the only way we were able to do a workaround was on December 30th, 2009. Jonathan Graves agreed to substitute himself as the plaintiff in that lawsuit from his individual trust, his beneficiary trustee, and that he would indemnify the trust for any costs and fees, sanctions that resulted from that 38-year-old lawsuit that was filed in Adams County.
Counsel, you've given at least the background of a lot of complexity, and I understand that. I want to move a bit to the issue of costs. Here, OLR is requesting the imposition of costs of $31,590, having reduced their initial request from $36,000. What is your position on the imposition of $31,000 plus in costs?
Well, there's another decision that was issued in this case. It was issued on January 1st of 2017, and it had to do with a great deal of time that was spent on the procedures that OLR follows as it relates to medical records. I never objected to them having my medical records, and in fact, I provided them on July 16th of 2015 with a DVD that had all of the records, medical records that had been obtained from the Pfizer case. As I pointed out in my materials, I had sued the pharmaceutical companies because the drug that I was on for 15 years caused my breast cancer. And on the 16th of July, all of those documents were electronically provided to OLR. The problem with this case has been that OLR feels that if you are using a medical affirmative defense, that your records are all going to be made public, because that's what I think it's 2250 says, that if you are involved in a case before the Supreme Court, all of your records go out to the public. I find that is certainly not consistent with the changes that were made to Wisconsin Chapter 146, 81 through 84. in 2008, and that shouldn't be happening. It's really a violation of Chapter 146, 81 through 84. In any event, we spent all that time, and that's what the bulk of that bill is for.
One of the things you are challenging with regard to costs, as I understand it, is approximately $5,000 in costs for a transcript from the Circuit Court of Dane County on the third count, that is the overbilling count that was dismissed. And I understood your argument in part to be that this cost was incurred after the judge had made findings, including your interpretation of underbilling. So it would help me if you would address with some specificity your objections to cost, if you're able to do that today.
Well, I believe that they should never have filed count three in the first place, based on Judge Neese's findings, which they had since December 16th of 2013. And what finally happened was when they did get an expert witness that knew trusts, they withdrew that charge. But in any event, I think that probably I can't tell by looking at their bill because they don't give enough specificity in terms of what they're working on. But my guess would be about at least $70,000 of that money, now that they've backed down somewhat, would be because they were playing these games about the medical records and whether or not they should be made public. And that's, they're not paying any attention that OLR and the Supreme Court should be following Chapter 146, that those records should not be made public, they should be sealed. And in fact, the referee came up with a very effective document as a protective order to be able to be used by their secretaries, their expert witnesses, but not to be released publicly, and that never proceeded to move forward.
Do you think any costs are warranted in this case to be assessed against you?
I don't think there should be any costs, and let me get into why there wasn't the invoice prepared. There are two affirmative defenses. One of them has to do with the fact that I'm a cancer survivor and I'm a breast cancer survivor. That lawsuit, what happened is, starting in fall of 2009, I downsized my practice. I had, on the same time I was working on doing the initial work on the trust, I was told that I didn't have cancer initially, but I went to see a cancer surgeon. And a year later, they finally said, oh, yes, those X-ray films from the computer were correct. So basically, I was downsizing my solo practice and also trying to work on this case. The specific thing that's very important here is that when I finally was authorized to start on this case, I basically had a lot more to do than anyone had thought. And Mrs. Graves had not finished putting all the marital assets in the trust. The firm that had started the trust in 2000 had quit on her. And so all the marital assets weren't in the trust to begin with. So I had to do that. Then I had to basically, after that was done, put them into the two sub-trusts so we get the tax exemption benefit from the federal government. And then finally I had to, in the third part, distribute all of these assets. So there was a lot of work. And what was stated by Judge Neese in his document was that I had to give my all to this. And what really happened is I ended up having like two 40-hour-week jobs because I had to do all this work evenings and weekends. And so what I found myself in was the inenviable situation of not having copies of the work that I was doing. I had made 8 house calls between January 5th and the date of her death, February 22nd. And all the documents that I had worked with her out there, I didn't have copies of those because many of those organizations required software that was filled in that you couldn't save on your computer. They were proprietary documents. The other thing that happened is all of the checks, all of the payments, everything I transferred, those documents all came directly to Mrs. Graves. So I had no confirmation of the work that I did. And when Timothy Graves tried to go into this arbitration thing, and I spoke with Ms. Wenzel at the arbitration organization, she said that this would be like it would be a paper trial. And at January of 2010, I was in no condition to be able to do a paper trial on over 8,500 documents. I had given this family my all. I had worked night and day, and in fact, on January 17th, I started at 6 in the morning, and I was still there at 2 on Sunday morning. Most of the days between the time I was able to start when she came back from the hospital till when she died, I was in there at 6 o'clock in the morning and working off until 10:30 at night. And you will see that in my Exhibit H with my objections. I simply was working day and night, and I worked with the assistance of Mrs. Graves herself and her two local sons in Wisconsin, who we all worked together day and night and night and day, which is why I know that Mr. Timothy Graves didn't represent any of these people. I have, as I said, in Exhibit A, my Exhibit K shows that Jonathan did not know he was out of the country when that lawsuit was filed. But the other thing that happened is Timothy Graves then said, oh, no, I'm the attorney of record for the trust. He never distributed any assets. This was just power grabbing. In his documents, if you will look at Exhibit R, and the same thing is true in the grievance, and the same thing is true in his request to do the arbitration where he wanted to interject himself, he basically is going on this whole concept of, you were Mrs. Graves' personal a lawyer, you are not working for the trust, and that I should have signed a representation agreement with him, which is not true. He was a beneficiary trustee, but at the time, initially not, because the beneficiary trustees were not actually funded to begin with until May 9th of 2009.
Counsel, we operate in this court on a timing system, and your time is up. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. So you should think about what important things you want to tell us in rebuttal. But right now, it's OLR's time to step to the mic.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice, Justices, and Attorney Wagner. You know, may it please the Court. I'm Bill Weigel. I'm representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation in this matter. Attorney discipline cases are difficult for a myriad of reasons. It's always an honor and a pleasure for OLR to be able to address the Court and provide its position in these cases.
Counsel, I want to know what we're talking about here today. My review tells me we're talking about one count, count number 2, and that count is an alleged violation of SCR 20:1.5, parent B, parent 3, because of a delay in providing a billing to a client. Is that correct?
That is the nub of the matter, yes.
Okay, and we are talking about costs, which we did a little bit more, but right now I just want to focus on the violation. So there's one violation before us, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
What about count one?
Count one was alleged. Count one was inadvertently by OLR's then counsel misstated in a memorandum in support of OLR's motion for summary judgment on counts one and two. The referee took that misstatement and phoned for OLR on count one using the mistaken subsection and also found that the violation, although proven, was de minimis. And OLR agrees that that violation, essentially think of it as one of these cases where somebody puts a check in a drawer and doesn't put it into a trust account for a long time?
I want to know the procedural posture with regard to count one. Are you asking that we reverse the referee's findings and conclusions that the OLR was entitled to summary judgment as to count one, or has it actually been yet dismissed?
It has not actually been dismissed because that issue was discovered very late, just prior to the time that OLR's brief was due.
Is there an agreement to dismiss it today, counsel?
Yeah, OLR had asked in its brief, I believe in a footnote, right, that the court dismiss the case. The court can do what it would like with regard to the evidence and record before it. OLR's position is it's proper to dismiss that. It doesn't matter. It doesn't merit a remand. It doesn't merit the argument. It would not be fair to convict her on a subcount that was not in the disciplinary complaint.
Okay, fine. Then I want to get back to the count we have before us that OLR wants to proceed upon, and I want to know who requested the billing from Attorney Wagner.
Jonathan Graves, on multiple occasions, let me address that, please,
Thank
Chief
you.
Justice. A lot's been said and written. There's a lot of issues been brought. But what it comes down to, and Attorney Wagner is right, Judge Neese found, and I can give, and I'll try to intersperse little oral, references to the record, Judge Neese found that really the real party interest here was Jonathan Graves as trustee. Frankly, no disrespect to him, Timothy Graves is a member of the Wisconsin Bar, as were a couple of the siblings. We could toss Timothy Graves out the window for consideration of this court's determination of whether or not Ms. Wagner violated 1.5B3. Attorney Wagner met with Wanda Lee Graves. Wanda Lee died in early 2009. Summer of 2009, late summer, Jonathan begins making requests that Ms. Wagner provide an invoice. That is best shown in the record by a document that is at R58 Exhibit I. In fact, most of what you ask, Chief, is best shown by the documents that are attachments to OLR Counsel's exhibits filed in support of summary judgment, and those exhibits are in R58. R58I is an email from Jonathan Graves to Kathleen Wagner. It reads in part, I have yet to receive your bill. I wish you would extend some common courtesy and get the bill to me. I have been more than patient in this matter.
What's the date of that one?
November 30th of 2009. So the end of 2009. Now by December 31st of 2009, about a month later, Attorney Wagner and Jonathan Graves meet. They agree to what is entitled fee dispute procedure. That's at R58 Exhibit J.
Okay, now, they meet for a fee dispute procedure, but if he didn't get a bill, how is he disputing the fees?
Well, the document kind of speaks for itself, and Ms. Wagner just said that she received a check that day or the day before, but the procedure essentially says, Attorney Wagner agrees to give Jonathan Graves her bill by February 15th.
Okay.
He can look at it. If he doesn't like it, he will request fee arb through the state bar fee arb program.
Okay. Thank you.
Both Kathleen and again Jonathan Graves signed that fee dispute document on January 15th of 2010. What I submit is also important. Kathleen Wagner drafted that document. She admitted that. It's R58 Exhibit Q, Request 29, one of the requests to admit. So she's supposed to submit a bill. She agreed to submit a bill. There's an agreed deadline of February 15th because for many months, Jonathan Graves has asked her and has wanted and has been overly patient in getting a bill. And if one wasn't forthcoming, there'd be fee-arb through the state bar. Kathleen wrote a letter to Jonathan Graves, R58 Exhibit P. I am confident that upon reviewing my itemized billing statement, we can agree on a fair fee. You can give Tim Graves the fee dispute agreement that you and I had reached. Tim Graves, I'm comfortable with the characterization of a disgruntled beneficiary for purposes of this argument and this rule violation. Tim Graves did request fee arbitration on January 8th of 2010, and I apologize for all these dates coming in, but I, like Ms. Wagner, thought the best way to understand and organize this was in the form of a timeline. So he requests FEARB. The application shows that the applicants are all four siblings, including Jonathan as trustee. By the way, that fee arbitration request, which is R58 Exhibit K, concedes that Ms. Wagner is entitled to at least a $30,000 fee. So when Ms. Wagner argues to you, and when she writes in her brief, one doesn't have to be an Einstein to ascertain that Tim Graves did not want to pay anything. It's on page 13 of her brief, last line of paragraph 4. Even the fee arb that he filed in early 2010 says that. $30,000, you know, we're not gonna argue about
it. Can I interrupt you and ask about that? Did you say that all four siblings were on the fee arbitration request? Or did I mishear that?
Again, without digging through the core documents, I believe that all four siblings as trustees were listed as applicants on the fee arbitration request from January 8th or so. It was signed only by Timothy Graves.
Well, that's why I'm trying to get at it. The gist of Attorney Wagner's argument on this point seems to suggest that this was all Timothy's doing. So I'm trying to understand, did he just put their names on it, or were they involved in putting their names on it, or is the record unclear?
I don't want to play that we'll get to that game, but I know that a little further along that's addressed with regard to Jonathan Graves' references to Ms. Wagner being unwilling and refusing to participate in that fee arb. However, Timothy signed it. Ms. Wagner takes that position. She's also taken the position in her briefing and even in response to the OLR grievance, and that's a part of the record here, our 58 Exhibit S, that when Timothy filed the fee arb, that voided her agreement with Jonathan. She no longer had to comply with the agreement she made with Jonathan to provide a detailed bill by February 15th. She no longer had to comply with the agreement she made with Jonathan to submit disputes to FEARB. Rather, that contract just somehow goes away.
Counsel?
Even if we find a violation of 20.1.5, sub 3, a lawyer shall promptly respond to a client's request for information concerning fees and expenses. Even if, and that's the only count that is a viable count any longer. 1, to be dismissed. 3, is dismissed, as I understand it.
Yes, Justice.
So, in Rajek, we found a violation but didn't impose any discipline. You're asking for a private reprimand. I didn't see any citation to authority for that in terms of cases where you have a sole violation, one count on this charge with no prior discipline history. So do you have any to offer?
Every case is different. There are several private reprimand cases in OLR's brief. Two of them involve, as primary misconduct, a 1.5B3 violation. Each also involves another violation.
Yeah,
one coincidentally was the $500 check in a drawer thing.
So does this mean, I was not able to find anything. I didn't see you citing any authority for a single count of this violation with no prior discipline. Is it your belief that this would be the first case with that kind of a factual situation?
Trust account rule changes so frequently, or has historically. I don't know that I have the ability to go back and research that accurately, but
okay.
I'm not aware of a case in the compendium that I could provide to you with one count and a private reprimand. I would, however, remind you, Justice Bradley, of your referee's recommendation, not binding upon you, but something you take into account, where he said, this conduct and her misconduct deserves more than a private reprimand. I am ratcheting it down, my words not his, to a private reprimand because of the mitigating circumstances that she's described with regard to her struggles with her medical conditions and some computer issues that she had referenced. So every case has got to be the first one ever for something or other. And what we have here And again, I admire Ms. Wagner's command of trusts and estates. I'm sure she's forgotten more about that work than I'll ever learn in my lawyerly lifetime, and her tenacity, and she has an attention to detail that can be astounding. But she's got clients who wanted bills for 26 months. You could say 29 months. You could say 26 and a half months. Time and time again, they asked for them. They asked for fee arb. They filed a grievance. They filed a lawsuit. They asked for admissions. They requested the circuit court judge to order her to comply and provide bills. The circuit court judge did so on several occasions. You can trace through those. And still, that billing was not forthcoming.
You're referencing her clients. Who is the client under these circumstances after Wanda Lee passed away?
Probably me speaking too loosely by referencing her clients, but the trust, and I believe it was the living trust, not the family trust. I think of it as just the administrative trust, and Jonathan was the successor death trustee. And so the client is embodied by, I believe, Jonathan, and Jonathan is the person OLR's position is that Ms. Wagner is primarily answerable to.
And who filed the Dane County lawsuit? Was that just Timothy, or was Jonathan involved in that?
No, the Dane County lawsuit and the complaint, or pages from the complaint for the declaratory judgment action, or R58 Exhibit R, named both Jonathan and Timothy, the other siblings. The complaint was signed by Jonathan in his capacity as trustee for one trust and his capacity as trustee for another trust.
Is Jonathan a lawyer licensed in Wisconsin?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Okay, is Timothy, I know he's a lawyer, is he licensed in Wisconsin?
I know that he was as of May 2009. I did not check in preparation for this argument.
Okay, thank you.
I thought it was undisputed that Timothy did not represent Jonathan. Am I right or wrong on that?
Timothy seems to have purported to act for Jonathan, including in filing the fee arb and in some of the lawsuit matters, perhaps he did. I think if you look at CCAP, he was on there, and he's filing lawsuit. And there's references to the plaintiffs. The plaintiffs demand this. She has not responded to the plaintiff's discovery request.
Is it undisputed? Timothy may think he represents Jonathan. What does Jonathan think? Did Jonathan ever assert that Timothy represented him? Maybe he did. Maybe I thought it was undisputed that Jonathan didn't think Timothy represented him, but I could be wrong on that.
Well, it's... You know, Jonathan filed an affidavit. It's at R58 Exhibit X, and it's talking about, and I'm not trying to avoid your question, despite multiple reminders and multiple requests to Ms. Wagner to provide invoices and documents, I still have not received either. I've been unable to get Kathleen Wagner to follow the fee dispute agreement. Attorney Wagner refused at least three efforts at fee arb. So Jonathan, in his affidavit, is complaining about Ms. Wagner not participating in fee arb, which is... Justice Bradley, that one.
The question Justice Bradley asked, and I'm interested in the answer to her question, is whether Timothy ever represented Jonathan.
I don't understand the record to be that he would have had any valid ability to represent Jonathan in any matters save perhaps the Dane County action. And frankly, in my analysis, I didn't get there because Jonathan was thwarted in so many efforts to get billings from Ms. Wagner. I thought, let's take Tim out of the equation. He is an irritant, and Ms. Wagner devoted a significant amount of time in her brief to a laundry list of perceived wrongs. We don't have to worry about that question, and I don't have an exact answer.
I don't know if we can take Timothy out of the equation, though, because does it matter? I'm assuming OLR takes the position it doesn't matter that Timothy and Attorney Wagner were involved in litigation. Does it matter then that it could be argued, and I think Attorney Wagner is arguing, that at that point the circuit court judge is kind of taking over and he entered a scheduling order, and I know there was noncompliance with dates given, but then there were extensions of those dates given, which I think was due at least in part to Attorney Wagner's medical conditions and experiences. So I guess, what is OLR's position with respect to, given the fact of the litigation being advanced by Timothy, what impact did that have on Jonathan's earlier requests?
Well, the litigation included, and it may have been in capacity as trustee, but Jonathan is a plaintiff, and Judge Neese's orders were consistently with regard to Jonathan. On October 13th of 11, our 58 Exhibit AA, Attorney Wagner, present Jonathan D. Graves with an annotated bill for services provided by your law office. Do it on or before November 1st. When he gave the new deadline, Judge Neese said, why in the world, literally use those words, page 9, why in the world haven't you produced the bill? That's our 58CC. I'm extraordinarily frustrated. This is a circuit court judge. I'm totally suspicious about the amount of time that's needed to do an adequate job of discovery responses. I'm totally suspicious you're not attending this in the manner you should be. This has been going on for close to a year now from my perspective, and we're still not to the point where we even have a bill produced. That's astonishing to me, absolutely astonishing. It is unprecedented in my practice and in Branch 9 and since I've been on the bench. That's why I'm frustrated. Ms. Wagner's request to the judge at that hearing, well, I need some time to send some interrogatories, 2 to 3 depositions, and name expert witnesses. Judge Neese's response, I'm going to give you one final opportunity to present documents. Barring that, you're not going to be able to use them. His discovery has been outstanding for months and months and months. We've given you deadline after deadline after deadline, which you have been unable to satisfy. And again, and I those are the words of the jurist that was handling this case. That
did Judge Neese impose any, did he impose any sanctions for noncompliance with the scheduling orders?
I'm going to give you one last chance because the Supreme Court requires me to, and that will be January 3rd, to produce the documents responsive to his discovery, barring which you will not use those documents in your case. Is there anything unclear about that? So he threatened sanctions. I don't believe he imposed them, or I'm insufficiently aware of the record to know what he may have imposed. And when Ms. Wagner complied, her last billable time was back in February of 2010. You know, back in February of 2010. She complied finally in January of 2012. So we have a period of a couple of years with people asking, begging, suing her, asking to arbitrate, trying to get a bill. A lot of money held in her trust account, and it just was not forthcoming.
Mr. Weigel, can you respond to Attorney Wagner's comment about the amount of money she believes was spent by OLR just trying to get her medical records? Do you have it broken down how much money OLR spent on what for that $31,000, not including the transcript?
No, I brought along our cost statement, which is in the record at R-121 and our reply to her objection at R-137 to explain some of those. I don't recall whether we filed an itemization. If so, it is in the record. If not, the court has and has exercised the ability to ask for one. You know, from OLR's perspective, which is different than the court's, I mean, costs are impactful, but costs are not discipline. Costs are an ancillary issue. The issue is, did we meet our burden of proof that an attorney clearly and convincingly violated rule this, rule that? And the other issue is, what might we suggest as being the appropriate level of discipline to impose if we met our burden of proof?
Right, but I'm assuming that
the cost
matters still to Attorney Wagner. It's a lot of money.
It is. The court can certainly exercise its discretion and find that these circumstances are either, whether you use the word extraordinary or at least merit an adjustment. And OLR is absolutely not pounding the table and saying, make this person pay $40,000. We're following our established practice by saying the costs were in large measure incurred because of the manner in which this attorney defended and litigated the case. The blind alleys, if you will, I don't mean to run down or denigrate, Attorney Wagner, but it's her presentation was described by both the referee and by Judge Neese as consisting of a lot of scattered, disorganized, detailed but irrelevant documentations and arguments. The HIPAA argument basically was, as far as OLR was concerned, a red herring. We just consistently filed things with referee Bowl saying, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. We're not pursuing that count. If we were pursuing that count, if she puts in documents, then she's consensually putting in documents. And by the way, let's seal everything. We didn't say everything has to be public forever. We said it goes into a court file, but certainly for sensitive information, including personal health information, it's appropriate those be sealed. We said as much. We suggested or admitted to referee Boyle as much.
Counsel, what was the resolution of the Dane County case?
The resolution of the Dane County case is embodied in it's a pretty quick answer, but I want to be able to at least tell you that it's a April 13, I think it is. April 24, 13 decision by Judge Neese. The transcript of that, as Ms. Wagner pointed out, is actually at R17, Addendum A.
The entry for that day suggests that there was a settlement. Is that
correct? Basically, Judge Neese said, you've asked for about $86,000 when you finally submitted a bill. Part of the reason you did that is because unilaterally upped your fee from $250 an hour to $350 an hour. That agreement in that letter is absolutely unenforceable and terrible, but I am going to give you a quantum merit of $275 an hour. Taking your bill at $275 an hour, I think you're entitled to, and I'm roughing the number, $64,000, $65,000.
So that was not a negotiated settlement. It was the court's decision.
And then, Ms. Wagner can fill in this blank better than I, but then he said, and you know, Ms. Wagner, you're entitled to a lot of fees. I'm finding you're entitled to $64,000, $65,000, $66,000 here. So basically, you won the case. Why don't you folks go back there and figure out what your costs and expenses are and see if you can come to an agreed figure? They did, if I'm understanding the record correctly, and said, Judge, the agreed figure is $74,000.
Okay. And was
$74,000 to Wagner, the rest of the trust.
And was Jonathan a part of that agreement?
Yes.
And was there a settlement agreement that got signed?
I don't know.
Was the settlement put on the record?
The $74,000 was, I'm believing. And I'm not sure where in the record that is.
Right.
With all of the documents and transcripts, it's in there, and I'm sorry. It may be a needle in a haystack for me to put my finger on it right now.
So further to, I'd like to address counts 1 and 3 as they relate to cost. The attorney's fees that were at issue in the Dane County Circuit Court, those are the same attorney's fees that were at issue in count 3 of OLR's complaint. Is that correct?
Pretty much so. Whether you figure that from OLR's perspective and from what the Preliminary Review Committee found cause to proceed prior to OLR's filing of the complaint, but after its investigation, is whether she's charging or attempting to charge $167,000, there was some information to that effect, and OLR had an affidavit to that effect, or whether she's charging or trying to charge $86,000, she upped her fee improperly from $250 to $350. Either way, it's an unreasonable fee.
Hang on. We've only got a couple minutes left here, and I got a few questions. So did OLR have access to the circuit court's decision before filing the complaint in this case?
OLR had access to the circuit court decision. Let me slide in one thing from that decision of Judge Neese. He said, originally, this is his decision, up until questioning on the fifth day of trial, I thought she was seeking compensation of the entire $167,000.
Okay. I don't want to get too far into this because we only have a few minutes. So OLR, Judge Neese's decision was there was no overbilling, correct?
Judge Neese's decision was that she was entitled to quantum merit in a lesser amount than what she had billed for or requested. But that she probably underbilled her time, which Ms. Wagner pointed out. She probably had bits of time she spent that she didn't bill for.
On count one, do you know if 1.15B4 was renumbered after the filing of this complaint?
Yeah, I think that B4 was renumbered with the trust account revisions, the most recent ones, which would have been, I think, effective in July of 2000.
What was it renumbered to? Do you know?
Something with an F. It was put into the fee rule, which is 1.5, and I'm going to say in or around 1.5F, Justice. The record in the proceeding, in the civil proceeding, we've all said it. It's voluminous. It's rather convoluted. Attorney Wagner just refused or was unable to bring herself to accept responsibility for producing a billing.
So one more thing on count three.
Yes.
At page 4 of your brief, you say, during litigation and following OLR's receipt of additional information, a thorough review of the underlying Dane County proceeding, and consultation with an expert on the fee issue, OLR withdrew count three. What information did you receive after having filed the complaint with count three in it that caused you to withdraw?
So there's a document, R-47, which was the voluntary dismissal of count three, and that explains OLR's reasoning for voluntarily dismissing. I don't have exact command of that information, Justice, and I'm fully responsible and happy to discuss all this case with you and aspects. Learned to me a lot about it in the relatively recent. I didn't try the case, and I wasn't handling the appeal originally. The original counsel who was on the case was then, the case was reassigned, I reassigned the case to alternate counsel, very able, competent, experienced, who's here. And her looks and her additional contact with the witnesses and her questioning of the affidavit. And frankly, again, I think reading that decision of Judge Neese from another perspective led her to recommend to me, we should think about dropping count three. The expert says it may be viable, but it's not a lock. And we sat down and talked to OLR Director Keith Saleen, who calls the shots in those matters. And he said, yeah, drop count three. So Attorney Spoke and I brought in Ms. Wagner to the Tenney Building and spoke to her about that and discussed our reasoning for and alerted her we were doing that, and that the OLR Director was had based upon that and the totality of the circumstances was now going to be seeking a private reprimand. That didn't end the discipline case, as it turned out, but that's how it happened. I'm very willing, again, to answer questions. I'm betting my time's pretty close to being done, but I believe there's just a clear failure to respond to Jonathan's requests. I have a laundry list I didn't half get to about Jonathan and Kathleen interacting in those requests. But given the mitigating circumstances and Ms. Wagner's lack of prior discipline, OLR believes imposition of a private reprimand is both sufficient but is appropriate as well. Can you go the reject route and impose no discipline? Sure, that's uniquely within the court's province to determine what discipline. Certainly, OLR will argue that the violation was very clearly proven. And again, costs, that's your call. They were necessarily incurred during the course of the litigation, but there's a ton of them. Sometimes that happens in private reprimand cases. You know, revocations can go like that. I think I just filed an itemization in a different case with an attorney from OLR who spent 2.5 hours of work, start to finish, and sometimes private reprimand cases were up here 5 years later arguing. Thank you very much for
Thank
your time.
Attorney Wagner, since you only have 5 minutes, I'm going to jump in right away and let you know what I would like to hear most about, and that is, if you can respond to what Mr. Weigel said about your interactions with Jonathan and his requests for your invoices and why those were not forthcoming.
Let me be very quick since I only have 5 minutes. You asked earlier whether or not the siblings, the other beneficiary trustees, were involved in the arbitration request or the grievance or the six-day trial in front of Judge Neitz? The answer is no. I'd like you to look at my answer, paragraph 59. In that paragraph, it indicates that Timothy Graves never had an attorney-client relationship with any of these people. And if you look at the CCAP for case, Dane County case 4069, it will show that this is the lawsuit that he filed alleging that I had committed fraud because I didn't tell his brother there would be interest to the family for the money in the trust account. And Judge Remington was in charge of that case, and he filed an order to show cause why these other people shouldn't be in the case, because on February 16th, he asked Timothy directly, and Timothy said that he had no attorney-client relationship with any of the other people, including Jonathan as the death successor
Attorney
trustee.
Attorney Wagner, I think what we are all wanting to know is why didn't you meet Jonathan's request? I get that Timothy was a thorn in your side, but we would like to know why it took 2 years for you to meet a request from Jonathan for a bill, and you acknowledge he was representing the trust. So we'd just like an answer to that.
Let me try to be very specific on that.
Great.
The request that I received was from Jonathan Graves' wife. It was an email from his wife on November 30th, 2009. At that point in time, we were on suspense. We were on hold because of what Timothy had done while Jonathan was out of the country. And as I said, we got around that. We did a workaround because if you look at Exhibit K, Jonathan agreed to be, for his personal benefit trust, to become the plaintiff so we could get around that and get that off so we could finish the case. I indicated earlier in my limited time that I had done all of this work night and day, day and night. And if you look at the bill, for example, item DD and their materials, it was, I believe, H and the ones that I submitted October 17th, I couldn't bill for everything because Timothy was demanding receipts. As I pointed out, I worked night and day. I worked 18-hour-plus days. I got all of this stuff transferred by the 31st of January, starting the week of January 17th when she came home from the hospital. I was working to get this stuff into the trust so there would be no probate and so the transfers would be done. I didn't have copies of anything. When the monies came in, all that money went to the homestead, to either Mrs. Graves or to Jonathan later on. So they got all the receipts. I had nothing to prove what I did. In addition to that, I did 8 house calls, and I spent hours and hours and hours going through the files with both of the sons, looking for other documents in terms of what was there. I have no documents showing how many hours I spent going through those basement files.
Counsel, is it true that the last services for which you billed on the bill that was provided in 2012, services performed in 2010?
That is correct. But we couldn't finish anything off, and we couldn't pay anything out because that case in Adams County was still pending, and we weren't going to release this money and then end up having to pay all this money. Now, what I want to say is this. Number one, I was downsizing my practice. I was very, very ill. And, in fact, when Timothy filed that lawsuit in Dane County, I was at that point going to the doctor's office 3 to 4 times a day to have the abscess cleaned with betadine and hydrogen peroxide, and then going and I had staph infections so bad that I was fighting for my life hour by hour, day by day. And he files this thing. Things didn't get better for me. I ended up having a kidney cyst. I have all these complications were side effects of the drug that I was on for 15 years. After the kidney cyst thing happened, May of 2011, I couldn't even stand up in the morning, and he still insisted on my showing up for a deposition, and he got admonished. I got a protective order, which OLR and the referees denies I got, but you now have it because it's in the record. And basically, that's how ill I was. I only got that one email.
Okay.
And the reason
your red light is on. I just want to be sure I understand why the delay. And your position is you were ill.
seriously ill during the two-year period between 2010 and 2012. Is that correct?
I had, if you look at the affidavits from the doctor, which were submitted, I think it was 67B, cancer was undiagnosed by year. When I had the first surgery, it was botched because the doctor wasn't told that I had multiple locations. I had to have a second surgery. Got that second surgery, and then got staph infection. My immunology was so compromised that it was taking years to be able to get back to normal. I took no new cases from summer of 2009 until summer of 2013, except for the pharmaceutical case.
Okay, thank you. I think we understand what you're presenting.
Okay, so I was really that ill, but I do want you to please look at my paragraph 59, I want you to understand that OLR's position that Timothy Graves was representing these people is false. It's inaccurate. And I was so sick that to file that kind of a lawsuit when I'm fighting for my life hour by hour, and they knew it, is incredible. But this is the reason I couldn't do a complete bill is I didn't have those receipts to show. I needed to get them from the other side. And if you will look at my submissions, I did two depositions. I did interrogatories. I had a trial subpoena. I asked for copies of all those confirmations of the money that they got, and they never gave me anything.
Okay.
So I had nothing to do the bill
on.
Okay,
we understand that you needed some receipts because of demands that were made on you. We understand
that you're
also compromised. But your red light has been on for quite a while. And we do operate on a time limit in this court. And we appreciate your coming. We appreciate your submissions. But we are concluded with this matter. Thank you. The court is adjourned. We will meet in closed conference at 3:15.